podcast and YouTube blog covering the German startup scene with news, interviews, and live events.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Joe from StartupRate.io, your startup podcast and YouTube blog from Germany, welcoming the unicorn founder, Michael Wax, here with me. Hey, how you doing?
Hey, Joe. Thanks for having me today.
Totally my pleasure. It's great to have you here. Before we get into the interview, I would like to acknowledge that this interview was helped by the Young Presidents Organization, founded nearly 75 years ago. The YPO is now the world's largest leadership organization, representing more than 35,000 chief executives, including you, across 150 countries. Members are connected by their shared belief that the world needs better leaders and that their business can be a driving force for good. Each YPO member has achieved significant leadership success at an early stage. They lead businesses and organizations that collectively employ more than 22 million people around the globe and generate over $9 trillion US dollar in combined revenue. That's a pretty big number, I would say. Usually we start a little bit with what you've been studying, and I see you quite got around the world. I see you studied at UC Berkeley, Oregon State, Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, and Technical University Munich. Can you walk us through a little bit? And of course, as always, the question is, what's your favorite dim sum?
Well, this, Joe, this feels like ages ago, and makes you realize how long this time is passed already. But I think I've always been a very curious person. I love to explore new cultures and immerse into new environments. And I was already expecting that you were asking me for where's the best party or where did you get the best education. But I think my favorite dim sum is certainly Tim O One in Hong Kong. I think it's definitely also made for student budgets and still, I think, earned a Michelin star by now. And at the same time, I must say I enjoyed all three places because of just the massive diversity.
You eventually ended up getting an MBA and a degree in mechanical engineering, industrial management. I'm curious. Are you still running around your house and fixing stuff as a typical engineer?
I'd say I was raised with a dad who's been very good with his own hands in terms of fixing stuff and doing stuff on his own. So I think that education was certainly more helpful for doing stuff around the house and whatever my six semesters of mechanical engineering. My wife may have heard the quote by myself a few times that, hey, like, go away, like, let the engineer come in. Yeah. Sometimes with more, sometimes with less success, but I think it would take too long to go into detail here.
I see. So basically she could still rely on you. I've seen that before you became an entrepreneur, you have been a trainee at Bain and a management trainee at BMW. And then you started to found a company. Can you take us a little bit through this journey, what you did before and how you ended up founding your first company?
Yeah, I mean, during my studies, I was curious to explore different careers. I was fortunate enough to then join Bain during my student times to help out with due diligences, predominantly on the private equity side and kind of like learn a basic consulting skill set there. It was interesting, but I think also this way I could find out that this is nothing that I would want to do for the rest of my life. And yet I'm super happy that I went through this school and got those hours of Excel and PowerPoint in, and certainly helped me in my later life as an entrepreneur. And then I actually founded my first company in 2013, a company called Konox, based in Munich, focused on railway maintenance. So basically sensor and analytics system to detect maintenance cycles for switches, allows for massive cost reduction of large railway operators. And after I left this company, then I spent a little time at BMW, kind of like probing a corporate career, which even though I met amazing human beings and super, super smart people, was not necessarily what I wanted to do for the rest of my life either. So I think I've been seeing the consulting world, the corporate world, early startup times, but I think once you were drinking from the fire hose once, I wanted to go back and basically wanted to build stuff in my own hands. And that's where I ultimately ended up at.
I see. Have you been ever fascinated by logistics, by transportation? Because with Konux, as well as with Forto, formerly Freight Hub, you've been always in the business of moving people, moving goods around.
I wouldn't say that I had a particular passion for logistics before then starting Forto, my second company, and the one that I'm today running as a CEO. But like, just one thing came to the other. I was very fortunate to meet during my studies my later co-founder, Eric Mutersbach, who has been for a long time the CTO and the co-founder of Forto. And he and I were spending a lot of time analyzing different ideas, going through a brainstorming period together with Fabian Ferry-Heinemann, who back then were already well known in the Berlin ecosystem for selling their first company, DataDeal, to Google in a pretty big lighthouse transaction back then. It was kind of like the first company that did a major exit to a big US tech firm. And Fabi had ties into the shipping scene. Eric and I were spending a lot of time with him, drilling into the industry, understanding how it works, what the value chain is consists of, because the early hypothesis was that it still remains to be an under-digitized market comparative to the size and the opportunity that it offers. Because in the beginning, you would say like the internet came into play, technology and software was eating the world. And at the same time, you would think that this process kind of happened alongside the largest industries. Like you would tackle the largest, mm-hmm. most beefy projects first. And with logistics, it certainly wasn't the case. So something was wronger. Something must have been preventing other companies from solving challenges with a lot more tech in the industry. It was still very paper-based, very manual. And when we came into the space for the first time, and I mean, just to give you a little bit of an idea how well-educated I was in logistics, I had to Google the word freight forwarding in January 2016, so just 8 to 10 weeks before we actually incorporated the company for the first time. We just happened to meet a lot of people that on the one hand were super unhappy with the way they've been receiving service in the industry. And at the same time, a lot of companies that were actually operators in the industry were very unhappy with the capabilities that are available there. And so we said, there's in one of the largest markets in the world, so global trade today is moving roughly $7 trillion of goods around the globe. More than 50% of global GDP is driven by trade itself. So there must be an enormous opportunity in digitalizing this end-to-end process and kind of like building a freight forwarding or logistics company on its own tech stack. And that's what we then started off with in early 2016. And what we up until today raised roughly $600 million in capital for, to make sure we create the new operating system for global logistics.
To give people a little bit more perspective on what you guys are doing, when I went through your company website, I realized you do have a presence in mainland China, in Singapore, and then on the other hand, on several harbors across Europe, including but not limited to Hamburg and Amsterdam. So basically, your business is right now focused on shipping, as you said, those overseas containers from the manufacturing hubs, China, but personally, I'm feeling increasingly Vietnam, do some reorganization maybe in Singapore and then get the ships out to Europe. Is that true?
So, I mean, what we ultimately do is you could see us kind of like as a booking.com for containers. for larger shippers. So we help companies to organize global logistics through a service that entails the trucking from the factory, maybe in Vietnam, China, Philippines, Indonesia, to the port, all the export declarations and document work, then loading the container or potentially also the air freight shipment onto the right vessel or plane, making sure the journey is being properly tracked and customers are informed about when the goods are about to arrive. Then we discharge the goods from the plane, from the vessel at the port or airport of destination, and we organize after customs the delivery to the warehouse. That's the scope, ramp to ramp, that Fortu covers for multiple hundred clients across Europe. And we do this in order to make the process more intuitive for them, to provide full transparency end to end, and to help them scale their businesses and to actually have make sure that they have time really focusing on the meaningful growth drivers of the business, because many times logistics is something like it's kind of like public transport. It just needs to run. And you don't want to be out of stock, because out of stock means out of business. And that's our core mission Fortu was being built on. So we want to make sure that shipping products for our clients is pretty much as easy as sending an email today.
When you talk about overseas containers and clients in Europe, what I have in mind is the classical stuff, from Christmas decorations to electronics to clothing to maybe machine parts or stuff like that. Would that be true?
I would say that today, so after 8.5-9 years of existence, in every German household, there is one product that Fortu has imported. So from nuts that are being put into Ritter Sport chocolate, flooring, ceiling, solar panels, sand, gravel, plaster stones at times. So I think there's a bunch of goods that you wouldn't believe is being imported. A lot of healthcare goods, a lot of industrial goods like pipes, hoses, and stuff. And so it's a wide mix of things. Some people at Fortu even made lists of the most funny items that we can import, but I'm not sure if kids listen to the podcast. I'm not going to list them entirely. Yeah, but I mean, there's a bunch of stuff that is not being produced in southern Berlin or Munich.
I see. You've been talking about your humble beginnings. I do believe you started with one specific category of product, ship in an online container, and then expanded. Can you take us a little bit along the entrepreneurial journey, what you did there, focus on one product and then expand?
And the very first customer we actually acquired, the day that I handed in my notice with, my previous employer, I met my boss for lunch, told him about my idea to kind of like build the kayak for containers, as there's too little digitization. I think he thought I was crazy, saying, listen, I mean, this market is governed by DHL. Like, are you really sure you want to do this? You have a great career ahead of you here. And I was like, yeah, I'm very sure I want to do this. And he told me a story about his kid just having bought a bike from an importer in Hamburg, a brand in Hamburg called Bovelon. So they make single speed bikes that seemingly was imported from Taiwan. And so I left the canteen. So I left the restaurant at the company back then, looked up the founder on LinkedIn, texted him and saying, hey, like, I'm running Kayak for Containers in Germany, and I really want to speak to you because I think we can offer you a better importing product for your containers. And that was like March 2016, and in May this became the first customer. Once we were able to launch our MVP, a couple of months later, we kind of shipped the first 100 containers. We had a bunch of customers in Germany, and we started predominantly with like servicing clients that were shipping up to 10 containers, or specifically were trying to sell their goods over Amazon. Yeah, so the category back then was called FBA, so fulfillment by Amazon. So those were people that would scout products during their vacation in Brazil or Thailand and say, listen, they have those amazing beach ball bats, or There's this amazing cat's toys that is being sold in Thailand, and I want to import this to Germany. And then Amazon would basically take care of the fulfillment, of the listing, of kind of like all the marketplace activities. They would do the idea generation, kind of like the creative part behind product innovation, find suppliers overseas, and we would basically run the entire logistics part. And this was a well-organized small ecosystem where we could get to a large penetration rather quickly. So we were known as the go-to party to serve those companies. And so we saw pretty rapid growth in that domain back then and helped a lot of those companies to ship and to manage their supply chains. Over time, though, this was kind of like the first niche, right? I mean, we went into this, let's say, very, very specific niche market. Over time, though, we saw that unit economics for larger customers were much better. It makes more sense to basically focus on a trade for a client where there's every week 4, 5, 10 containers. So the same processes, the same partners, more reliability, better planning, more sophistication on the customer side. Because in our initial customer group, it may have happened that people were hanging up on calls because they had to learn for their math exam the day later, or because they've never used a computer before because they were either too young or too old. So a very diverse set of partially rather unsophisticated businessmen. Orban. And so over the course of time, we've been shifting more upmarket. And today, we pretty much predominantly serve customers that actually have more than 500 containers a year that they import or export.
I was thinking about the business you're doing. You said you have some bigger customers that are shipping 5 to 10 containers each week. I kind of get the feeling that there are seasonal peaks in what you're doing with that. What comes to mind is, I do believe a container ship usually takes 4 to 6 weeks, somewhere from Asia to Europe. So there should be quite a busy time already started, and that will go until, let's say, end of October. Is that true? And how do you cope with those peaks?
So I think overall logistics is partially seasonal business for multiple reasons. Number one, obviously, because of consumer demand. Certainly Christmas is playing a big role. Companies, retailers want to be in stock for that season, want to make sure they can get customers to shop for presents. But at the same time, also on the supply side, because given the fact that a lot of goods are being transported from China, you need to also look at their vacation holiday sequence. And so in early February, late January, usually you have a Chinese New Year where nothing has been done for at least a week. And so a lot of transports are being shipped out just the days before, because then for a certain period, so February is usually kind of like a very slow month, and nothing is being produced, so nothing can be shipped. And so obviously you build systems that automate and digitalize the process to an extent where you can cope with those volatilities much better, so that the same number of people can process more shipments. That's one very important measure. Second one, you employ and roll out AI to the degree that operators in Italy or operators also in Poland can process shipments in Germany or also in China, because like it's pretty much independent what their native language is, because you can real-time translate all the communication and the correspondence. So that has been a big lever. And third is obviously very proactive, predictable planning with our customers. And that's something where we've built a lot of tech for, to make sure you can forecast volumes and better predict those peaks.
We talked about peaks because there's of course the seasonal peaks, but there are also the peaks of economic activity in the economic cycle. You once said in an interview that something around 200 million overseas containers are moved annually, and I do believe events like, for example, COVID, especially the zero COVID policy in China, must have had a huge impact on your business. How have you been dealing with that?
So the container shipping industry is not that old yet, right? So the first containers actually arrived in Bremerhaven roughly 1966. So that's roughly 60 years ago. Only 60 years. And back then, on an annual basis, you would probably count maybe 80,000, 100,000 shipments. And all of that was predominantly an innovation in the post-Vietnam War times, where they had to make sure that goods are being shipped back and forth in a very efficient way. Today, multiple hundred million containers are being processed every year. I think it's a bit more than 200 million. It's very difficult to get the exact number on a year-to-year basis. But this year, I think it's supposed to be 213 million. And that today marks, I think, roughly 53-54% of global GDP. So trade as a whole in terms of global GDP. But now the last 2 or 3 years, and I think COVID was one of those events, you've been seeing massive disruptions in the market. In early 2022, people thought supply chains would come to a halt. No more people could work in warehouses. No one would want to order something anymore. And then a big surprise came, because people did want to buy anything that made the house more enjoyable or outdoors more fun. And there was never a more busy period in international shipping than when people were hoarding the latest PlayStation, a new TV, a new sofa, a new refrigerator, and kind of like renovating or decorating the third or fourth house, because it's so much fun to be out in the countryside again. And that was the absolute heydays for shipping, and being a very inelastic industry. So it takes years to build a ship. It takes decades to build a harbor. That industry was certainly pulled to the extremes. So you had massive bottlenecks. At peak times, 60, 70 vessels were waiting out of Long Beach in order to discharge goods that they were shipping there. This means there was a lot of idle capacity that wasn't able to run around the world anymore. So while there was record demand, you had actually less supply, so less ships that were ultimately running back and forth. You had a lack of empty equipment. I mean, in those months, the steel price has skyrocketed by 3 to 4x, 300 to 400% price increase of a commodity, just because the demand for steel containers grew so quickly, so large. And that was just an insane time. Container rates for shipment between Shanghai and Hamburg were growing and rising from roughly $1,000 per container to $10,000 per container. So tenfold increase in a matter of months. And that was kind of like the first step where you could see through a volatility period that I think still is not over. After COVID, Russia invaded Ukraine, again, ripple effect through the economy. Consumers became more prudent in terms of spending. Inflation was at record high. Disposable income was shrinking. Preemptive purchases were made, and so less demand for shipping of goods has ultimately tempered and cooled off the market to a certain degree. While there was record order books, so all the carriers, all the ship owners have ordered ships like hell because they made so much money during COVID. And if your business is doing ships, like if you make a lot of money, you order more ships, right? It's it's crazy, but it's true. It's always been the case, and it's pretty predictable. So in the year of 23 and 24, record deliveries were forecasted and predicted to hit the market in a period where certainly consumer demand was quite soft. And then October 7th, Hamas invaded Israel in a brutal terrorist attack. Since then, obviously in the entire Middle East, there's, I think, very difficult to find the right words. Obviously, there's more or less a full-blown war ongoing, partially hot, partially cold. But ever since early December last year, the Houthis, a rebel formation in Yemen, has been attacking ships very aggressively. So they would build drones, they would build rockets that would pretty much randomly attack international cargo vessels to disturb international cargo flows. And that has been leading to the fact that the busiest canal and the busiest trade lane between China and Europe has been significantly disrupted because no more ships or hardly any ship is crossing the Suez Canal today. So a canal that is usually responsible for carrying roughly 10 to 15% of global trade through the passage right between the Red Sea and then Egypt, and you basically end up in Greece, Tunis. That's locked up. Like no ship is passing that anymore. That means ships need to go around the Cape of Good Hope. Takes 10 to 15 days longer. So you were reporting before 4 to 6 weeks. Yeah, I would say roughly 25 days was a regular transit time for a vessel between Asia and Europe. Now this is all of a sudden 40 days. So 30% longer. And if it takes 30% longer, it means that 30% less vessels can complete a journey during a certain period of time. So you have a massive equipment and capacity scarcity because the journey just takes so much longer. And in a time where demand and consumer spending is just picking up again, global trade is again going through a massive crisis. Yeah? And even though you may not read this on a day-to-day headline in a newspaper anymore, this is something that really keeps a lot of people busy in the world right now.
My wife works in supply chain. I think there's nothing more to say about that.
Yeah.
As you described, there's a massive industry out there with its ups and downs where you have to react on. And you've been doing a bunch of good work, which eventually ended up valuing your company as unicorn. You haven't disclosed this particularly yet, but I've read some estimates with the valuation around $2 billion valuation for Fortor. With latest investment round in March 2022. First, congratulations to that. And secondly, there are not so many people out. Don't get me wrong. There's a lot of people out there who want to found a unicorn right from the start. But I would be curious, how did it feel the moment you realized you set your signature under the contract and you realized, well, this is a unicorn. This is really big. What went through your mind?
I think a lot of founders for a period were excited about growing a company to that size, predominantly because of, let's say, public perception, right? It helps you with hiring. That's the number one reason. Everything else about it sucks. And so the moment we've been raising around and did the announcement, I mean, that you were just basically you're under enormous pressure to deliver. So expectations are sky high. There's no merit in basically carrying a large valuation around. And I think there's also no merit in having a company that's valued in private markets at that kind of level. Because ultimately the payday matters, like, the day that you're, whatever, going public, the day that obviously also employees get to earn a fair share. So I think a private market valuation per se is nothing that a company should and should be proud of. And if at all, it's just a milestone on delivering on your mission. And so I didn't feel especially great that day. If at all, I was a bit nervous and anxious if I can deliver on the expectation.
Usually I have a little bit different structure, but you've been talking about talent. Unicorn valuation helps you to raise talent. Are you currently looking for talented people?
You're always looking for great people at Forto. I think we can provide a very mission-driven environment, very hands-on environment. If you want, you get a ton of responsibility. And you can really make a lot of great learnings for your career and work with super experienced professionals in their respective field. I think right now I'm hiring for a particularly interesting role, the chief of staff. So you'd be working very closely with myself on all kind of strategic matters around Forto, or pretty much on whatever Forto needs. It could be very technical, it could be very strategic, but you would really get to learn and see a organization inside out, communicate to the organization, communicate to investors, make sure that you help the executive team to run and work more efficiently and effectively. And that's what I'm currently very actively interviewing for.
I've gotten that basically the day you signed the contract, you were co-founder of Unicorn, you were anxious. How did your friends and family react? Did your wife at least tell you she's proud of you?
Back then, I wasn't married yet. I think it was just super intense times, right? It was during COVID, so it was 100. We only had remote calls. So days prior to this signing, I probably worked 90 to 100-hour weeks, and I can only remember that I kind of like left the notary at 5 a.m. in the morning and fell asleep for a long time. Other than this, you get invited to a lot more events, which just takes a lot of time. So that's something where I had to learn to say no to a lot of stuff, because you can basically just fill your day with speaking slots and panel sessions. And ultimately, what I think I want to do and what I should do is speaking to customers, building product, and making sure I run a company efficiently. But that was certainly a big change, right? After this, friends, family, not so much. I don't think my parents are following the development of the company very actively, if at all. I think they're worried that I'm working too much. And the first thing they're asking is if the grandkids are doing well. I mean, then they're not super interested in the business.
Know that feeling. I really know that feeling. You do have a pretty good sense of business. And before we get into what you're doing as a business angel, I would be curious about one opinion from you. What kind of business would you start this very day? If you would need to start a new business, what kind of business would you be interested in?
I think it's a good question. I think it's a very difficult question right now, because there's probably hasn't been a time that where you had so just massive technological advancement on all sides. And so it's difficult to foresee how industries will unfold. I would do something in the logistics and supply chain industry again, where I'm sure that I can, with technology, just cut a lot of cost and make sure I run processes more efficiently. But hey, wait, I mean, this is pretty much Forto, right? So, I think there's no other right idea right now that I'd be more excited to spend my time on.
We already hinted that you're also active as a business angel. Can you tell us a little bit if you do have a mental framework for selecting, those investments? And are you also looking actively, or do you get more than enough pitches already?
So, I particularly enjoy working with young founders. I think it's always an enormous pleasure to work with people that are very driven and ambitious, really want to change and kind of build the world that they want to live in, right? So there's a lot of energy, drive, and creativity coming with it. And I really, really enjoyed it a lot. Predominantly to like help with stuff I had to painfully learn, and ideally where I can pass on learnings or experiences that helps to make those kind of learnings in a less painful way. So over the past 5 years, I roughly made 55 investments into very different companies. I don't have a specific focus, but there's the majority of those investments are B2B companies. I'm excited about anything where the founder really can tell a compelling vision, and where I believe that the team has what it takes to really build a great company. The resilience that you need, the expertise to tackle a specific problem, and the unique insight that reflects that they really understand the market well. I'd say that over the past, I've learned that you don't just need a great team, but you need to operate in a great market. I think even if it's just, let's say, as a solid team, but not an outstanding team, if they're operating in the right market, they can still create outsized returns. While even if you have the best founding team possible, if they're operating in a very difficult market, it's probably very complex to create outsized returns. And so I love to work with people that I got to know already for a while, and may it have been through their time at Forto, may it have been through joint time at universities, or introduction through fellow founders or VCs. I'm also, I think, by now, investor in a couple of VC funds and work closely with a couple of funds together. And people first, topic second, and the match of the two is kind of like the final yes.
That is actually the most cohesive framework I've heard so far about business angel investment. If people are pitching you, and at the very end, we'll get to how people can reach out to you. What is usually how and on what basis do you interact? You already said 55 investments so far. I do believe they will not all be big. Most of them with other business angels. So there's usually a group that the founders can rely on. In what capacity do you work with them? Whether you add value for the founders?
I'd say I can help predominantly with three topics. Number one is go to market. I've been in B2B sales now for 11 years. I think I know a bit about how to reach out to the right kind of customers and sell your product. Second is fundraising situation. So, I mean, I've been raising a bit more than probably $700 million of capital so far. If you take into account all the rounds that I've been seeing with companies I'm invested in, and where I help founders, like the number is in the billions. And so I think I've been seeing a fair share of fundraising dynamics and situations. And that's where founders then often call me up on whatever a daily basis, just for like a 3-minute check-in, like, how should I do this? Like, should I write an email? How would you negotiate that? And so, I also love that kind of deal time and, whispering some of the learnings I've made, and pass them on. And the last topic is co-founder conflict or different team dynamics or difficult team dynamics. I think number one reason why companies fail is because teams break. That happens on a day-to-day basis. It's very difficult to open up with those kind of topics to a lead investor. And so an angel is a great outlet there, right? You don't expect a follow-on investment from them. You don't have them on board for the money. Most of the angel investors know that you probably have to write up at least a third of your portfolio. So, they're not particularly mad at you when, the investment right now is not, showing a clear return, but they're ultimately there to help, right? And those situations, when companies are, let's say at a brink, I think are, make or break moments. And that's when, I've also made my fair share of learnings and experience in the past. And I think, I can help there to, sort out topics that have built over time.
And now would be for the last question, because we're running already at more than 40 minutes here. My last question would be, people are now interested in being, in pitching you as a business angel, how would they be able to reach you?
Well, reach out to me via LinkedIn, or ideally, even better, you find someone that I know and trust, and you get an introduction. That usually helps to get time much quicker. I mean, obviously, running a company is enough of a day-to-day job, so it fills my agenda quite well. And so I usually just reserve 1 or 2 hours on a Friday afternoon to speak to a few founding teams. And study pitch decks before, go through a deck and material so I'm prepped for the conversation. But then I also expect the proper pitch from the founding team, and so that they can guide me through this journey and the story, beginning to end, explain why they're building the company, what unique insight they're building the company in, why they have the capability and the skills to build a solution that'll tackle the market. And then they can also articulate well in easy words how that will work and look like. And I think it's a skill that founders need to build out early on, right? You will be telling a story for the rest of your period as an entrepreneur, and that just needs to come across well.
I would say that I pretty good closing words. Everybody who'd like to learn more, go down here in the show notes. There will be, of course, a link to your career website of Forto. There will be a link to your LinkedIn profile and a lot of other information we had. By the way, you've been talking about Long Beach. That is the main container terminal in LA where a lot of Chinese goods are shipped in through containers. Just want to add this here at the end. Michael, it was a pleasure having you as guest. Thank you. Thank you very much for taking the time, because apparently you said you decide what to do and what not to do.
Joe, thank you very much. Pleasure was all mine, and speak very soon.
Take care. Bye-bye.
That's all, folks. Find more news, streams, events, and interviews at www.startuprad.io. Remember, sharing is caring.